Welcome back.
Hi, we finally returned.
Woohoo, to mysteries.
Murders.
Monsters.
And your mom.
And your mom. I'm Julie.
I'm Nicole.
And we're back.
Yeah.
Summer vacations.
Oh, all the things.
Yeah.
Vacations, events, work.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Shit.
It's been a lot. I don't know what happened to June. I like laughed.
It's fucking over though.
I laughed the other day and I was like, this can't be real. Like,
what
why
the
are
hell?
We talking? Somebody was like something about the 4th of July. And I'm like, why are we talking about that already? And they're like, because it's next week. And I was like, oh,
what happened?
Yeah, it totally just June. I don't even know. It vanished into whatever.
Oblivion.
Canada wildfire smoke, apparently.
I know, right? Wasn't that crazy? That was crazy.
So crazy.
I've never experienced it. And you know, I mentioned this to Jared. I'm like, wildfires happen all the time, and we're in the jet stream where shit gets pulled to us. And not once in any of these wildfires that have taken place in the past has ever really affected us. I'm like, so why is it so bad this time? Like, there's got to be a reason, right? Like, this shit doesn't just magically happen on its own. But anyway, that's neither here nor there.
I just think this is the biggest, what I understand is the biggest fire that they've ever had in Canada.
Wow.
Ever. Like, this is record-breaking vastness of wildfire. So, like, I think that's why. I was talking to someone at work whose daughter lives in California, I think. No, I don't know. Somewhere out west. Somewhere westy.
Yeah.
And they were like, usually when we go visit them in the summer, it's like that there the whole time. Yeah. So, like, I think the other thing is we're just so not used to it.
Yeah.
I think other parts of the country deal with this a lot more regularly than we do.
Well, I mean, it's part of nature. Like,
a
natural occurrence. But, like, I don't know if it's because we live in a less... it's fucking humid here. I don't know. Because we live right in the middle of fucking Appalachia. We don't seem to have that problem.
Yeah, we just don't have the same climate and the same massive... We don't have that much... I mean, if you look at the eastern half of the United States versus the west, we're so much more developed. We don't have the vast swashes of, like, you know...
Yeah.
And Canada, like, Canada has tons... And but like they always like they have wildfires, but this has been record breaking.
We went through Yellowstone, you know, that one time we went through Yellowstone and we went through a part that had burnt down, and it was just really interesting to see like the new growth.
Mm-hmm.
Because enough time had passed from when that fire took place to when we were driving through it that you could obviously tell that a wildfire had gone through it, but there was so much new growth and new trees. It's just like that, like Phoenix cycle is just really cool to see.
It is cool. I mean, you know, obviously some of them are obviously started by assholes who don't know how to be people in
forest.
The woods.
Yeah.
So let's be clear about that.
You know,
let's not let the assholes off the hook, because I'm not here for that. No, I'm just kidding. But yeah, I mean, some of it is just natural, like, growth and rebirth, and then some of it's people being dickheads.
So you're first this week.
Oh, cool. So I have a title.
Okay.
Which is so on the nose that it's so ridiculous, but I did it anyway. So my title is On the Road.
On the Road.
All right. So I'm going to talk today about Leah Toby Roberts, or Leah Roberts. She was born in 1976, so she's just 2 years older than me, or, well... We'll just say theoretically, she's 2 years older than me.
She was possibly 2 years older.
You know, I was doing that thing where I was reading through like one of those articles of like different like unsolved cases.
Yeah.
And I was just like, that's interesting. And then I got to this one and I picked this one because like, I'm like, oh, like even the picture of her in her very 90s clothes and like everything, I'm like, oh my God, I feel like I was her. Like,
oh,
I was,
wow, yeah.
Yeah, like,
long lost
obviously
sister.
Parts of her that I'm like very much like I was like very relatable to me in that time period, like in the late 90s, early 2000s. And I'm like, oh boy, wow, okay, well, I'm going to do this one. And I'll mention that along the way. But I had to do it. It was just like, all right. And it's actually a pretty interesting case. So anyway, she's the youngest of three siblings. So she has a brother and a sister. She lived in her family, in the suburbs of Durham, North Carolina. And her life was pretty normal up until when she turned 17. Her father was diagnosed with a rare lung disease that kind of like, you know, upended all their family, everything. It was pretty crazy going on and all of that. And in the middle of all of this, the following year is when she left to go to North Carolina State University in Raleigh. So she starts college, you know, with her dad having these health issues and everything. And then during her sophomore year, her mom died suddenly of heart disease. Like, she had a heart attack. Yeah. So she took some time off school at that point to, you know, just to grieve her mom. And she told her older sister, this is a quote, "I feel born," she felt born again into this new life without a mom.
Okay.
And in the fall of 1998, she went back to school after her break. And then, on top of that, she was in a serious car accident. That resulted in a punctured lung and a shattered femur. And they inserted a metal rod next to her femur to help it heal.
Yeah.
These things are not the part that relates to me, by the way.
Well, except for the wrist, maybe.
Maybe, but that was not till I was 30. My parents are both alive. Anyway, I just wanted to be clear. Someone's going to be like, oh my God, Nicole.
Is this the relatable part?
But anyway, so like, you know, so things are going, like, things are just shitty, right? Like, this is a lot. And then she, again, she told her sister, like, she keeps seeing this born again stuff. Like, she felt like she was going to die, but she was born again after her recovery. And like, she's just in that age where you're just trying to keep finding yourself.
Yeah.
And all these things keep happening that kind of like fuck with your, like, I have this path and then all this shit keeps happening.
Like, I found myself. I lost myself again. Oh, I found myself. Yeah. Nope, I lost myself
so,
again.
Which I don't know why I included all of it, but I thought it was so funny because it's so typical of that age, right? Like, that's just who we are at that age. So anyway, she again had to take more time off from school, but she kind of like had this new lease on life where she's like, you know, I just need to go out there and get, you know, live life.
Yeah.
So she goes back out, and in the spring of 1999, she was in school and they were going on a trip to Costa Rica for her, like for field work. So she was super excited about the trip. She was going to be going on this trip for school. And her dad dies.
Oh.
So she decided to go on the trip anyway, even though it was like really close.
Yeah.
But one of the things that happened there is important for later. So I'll mention that she gave her sister power of attorney because she had been, you know, left money from her parents' death.
Yeah.
So her sister had power of attorney since she was leaving the country and going on a trip, like, you know, if anything happens. Which it's really funny to me to think about, because I'm like, man, at that age, I wouldn't have thought about any of that.
Nope.
Whatever.
Nope.
So she did. And this is a good thing because she. Yeah.
Whatever. Yeah. You'll get there.
Yeah. So her degree, she was getting a degree in Spanish and anthropology, and she's literally 6 months from being done, and then she quits school.
Oh.
And I was like,
what the fuck?
And her sister and brother both tried to convince her to finish. And like, as a person who works in higher ed and deals with students and trying to get them to finish school and like be successful, I'm like reading this and I'm like, don't do it. You'll never finish.
Yeah.
Like, anyway, you're so close. Just finish. And then I had to stop myself. So it's fine. So she didn't. And there's her sister has a quote here about, well, no, actually I'll save it for later because it doesn't really apply yet. I don't know why I put it there. I just like found it and I'm like, oh, this is great. And I put it here.
Yeah.
I'm like, anyway, all about the quotes this week. So she learned to play guitar. She took up photography. She adopted a pet kitten that she named
something.
B. I'm going to say B. B-E-A.
Bay.
Bay, B.
Yeah, something.
Anyway. But she had inherited this money, right? So she didn't have to work. And she's just kind of like living this like free
good life,
wheeling like I got money life. That is totally what I would have done at that age.
Who wouldn't have, right?
She spent a lot of time at a local coffee shop called Cup of Joe, where she'd work on her computer and was, you know, writing and hanging out with new people and making new friends. And I laugh because it's like, I don't know, late 90s, you hang out in a coffee shop. Everyone's a writer, aren't they? Like,
do you ever go?
And I'm not even trying to like down her at all, because like maybe she really was a really good writer,
right?
And like her sister, I think in one of the things I read said something about like, yeah, like she was totally gonna write the next American novel. I'm like, yeah, I think I said that like 100 times. Obviously I haven't.
I'm gonna write the next great teen vampire love story. That's my aim, because you don't really have to write well.
No, not anymore.
No, and you don't really need much character development. You just need. Never mind.
No, I'm with you.
That's about where I'm at with my literacy writing skills. Anyway.
So anyway, the relevance of this is that she spent a lot of time writing and she started to become obsessed, like all good coffee shop girls do, because I was one of them, with the beat poets and writers. Because, you know, we got to get our Jack Kerouac in.
All of the books.
So, but she was specifically into his book Dharma Bums, which is a semi-autobiographical novel about his time at a fire lookout in on Desolation Peak in the Cascade Mountains in Washington State. And it's like, it was a very significant event in Jack Kerouac's life. And he mentions it in multiple books. It's also in Desolation Angels and Lonesome Traveler, which I like Desolation Angels better, but anyway. He hitchhiked out there from 1956. You know, he went to find himself at this, you know.
I get the title.
Yeah.
Okay.
On the road, yeah. So she's kind of really obsessed with this whole idea of going to some place like he did and, like, finding yourself, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this kind of escapism is kind of what she was looking for. One of her friends expressed a strong, like, one of her friends from the Cup of Joe place says that, you know, she totally knew she, at some point, she was going to take off and go to the mountains because she wanted to go where Jack Kerouac went, you know, and like, oh my God, it's so cliche, but like, I like totally relate to all of this. Cause like in that time and like obviously outgrew it, but like in that time it was like the thing.
It seemed like the right thing.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So now to the crux of the whole thing here. So Kara Roberts, that's Leah's sister, calls her sister on the morning of March 9th, 2000. And she's on the phone with her, and her sister seems fine. She doesn't give any indication, like, that she won't talk to her again soon. Just kind of like, you know, normal conversation. Then, later that day, she makes plans with her roommate to help her with a babysitting job the following day. But later it would be discovered that on that same day, after she made those plans with her roommate, she withdrew $3,000 in cash, loaded her most valuable possessions into her car, and left town around 6 p.m.
Okay.
And her roommate really didn't notice anything at first because, like I said, she's not working, so she doesn't have a set schedule.
Mm-hmm.
So her roommate said, like, you know, she just came and went a lot. So, like, her not being around when I, like, because her roommate probably had to work.
Yeah, but also the stuff. Maybe she didn't have that much stuff.
I don't think she, like, went into her room. Like, oh, I think they, I like, had a very, like, your room, my room situation going on.
Yeah, yeah.
But, like, she didn't really notice anything at first because she was just like, oh, yeah, Leah's not here. It's whatever. And then on Friday the 10th, the next day, she didn't show up for that babysitting job that they had planned.
Mm-hmm.
So she thought she had forgotten, and so she still didn't really do anything about it. Because, I mean, I get the impression that she probably, if you're, like, her, like, 22 years old, you don't have to work.
Yeah.
And you're just, like, she probably wasn't the most reliable at this point. Because there's no, like, she's dropped out of school. Like, there's nothing holding her to things. Yeah. So 2 days pass before she, like, and now, like, her car hasn't been in the driveway for, like, 2 days, and now friends are calling the house looking for her after she missed plans with other people.
Oh.
So finally, she's like, all right, I need to call someone. So that's Sunday the 12th, she calls Leah's sister, Kara, and they basically start calling around people to try and find her like you would do.
Right.
And then the following morning, on Monday morning, March 13th, Kara searches Leah's room. And this is when they discover that many of her clothes and other belongings are missing, suggesting that she packed voluntarily. Like, not like she was a victim of a crime.
Right.
Like, because right now your mind's going a million places.
Yeah.
But, like, she clearly, like, left with purpose. It wasn't like she just up and, like, someone abducted her.
Yeah.
The cat was gone, too, so she must have taken the cat.
Aww.
Which, that's the part I was like, how did the roommate miss the cat? But whatever.
Yeah.
But they, because of the way things had been lately, nobody found this odd.
Right.
You know, nobody was like, oh my gosh, like, I can't believe she did this. Like, everybody was kind of like, okay. But she still reported her missing because she still just wanted to have contact with her. So the next day, the 14th, they searched her room again. And this time they found some notes. And they found a piece, folded piece of paper. Oh, here we go, more cliches. of the, it's like a drawing of the Cheshire Cat.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And of the grin, you know, the smile. And yeah. Of course, she was also really into Alice in Wonderland.
I mean, what girl isn't? I mean, let's be real.
And she, her sister thinks the drawing was meant to convey her intent to spontaneously disappear and eventually reappear. Which, like, I can just see someone being that dramatic, right? Like, that sounds very, like, because...
She's leaving, like, clues. And
yeah, and she's just like, I'm just going to leave and come back. And they'll be like, oh, my God, you left and now you're back. Like, I don't know. It's so weird. There was also a note that was kind of odd. And it did... Now, I will give her credit because it included cash to cover the month's worth of expenses.
Well, that was nice of her.
For her roommate. And so it did, but it also meant that she intended to return.
Yes.
Like, you're not just going to give up money for a month's worth of stuff. And then, like, if you were just going to bail, then you were going to bail. You'd be
bailed. Yeah.
Yeah. Some of the note was, like, kind of vague. And then others were, parts were a little ominous. After a brief introduction, she writes, "While I'm gone, remember everyone is together in thoughts and prayers and time passes quickly. Have faith in me, yourself, everyone."
Okay.
Yeah, that's what I said.
I fucking hate thoughts and prayers.
Same. In various asides, she offers her room and laptop to other people, which is kind of strange. She tells them that there's cookies in the freezer, and she tells Nicole, it's directed to her roommate, the note. She tells her to give everyone her love and asks them to tell her sister not to worry. And she also declares in the note, "I'm not suicidal. I'm the opposite. Remember Jack Kerouac," and she spells it with whack, which I thought was hilarious. Like K-E-R hyphen O hyphen W-A-C-K.
Kerouac. Oh, okay.
Kerouac.
But okay.
This is where they get the...
She's enunciating it out for
them. Like, this is where they get the idea that... And she mentions the novel On the Road as well. So they're like... They basically feel pretty strongly that she's just... going on this trip.
Yeah.
But she wanted to be, like, sly about it. So, like, I'm not saying they're not concerned.
She wanted to be deep about it.
Exactly. I'm not saying they're not concerned, but they feel a little better at this point. So I'll go back to the quote from earlier. So her sister was on Larry King Live, and she said, "By the time Leah was 22, she had lost both her parents, and here she is on the verge of graduating college, and I think she really just felt lost and didn't have a lot of direction. I felt like she took this trip as a soul-searching trip." Anyway.
Makes sense.
Which at all,
if you can,
you
should.
Right. Like, I just, you know, just tell people you're going to go.
Don't disappear.
That's a silly thing to do. And
it's dumb. And that's how you end up a missing person.
Right. It might have saved her life. So, like I said, she had power, her sister had power of attorney over her assets prior to the Costa Rica trip. So, she started looking at Leah's bank statements and trying to figure out where she was.
Yeah.
Yeah, and what was going on. So they discovered that on March 10th, she was in a hotel in Lebanon, Tennessee, before heading west on I-40 using her debit card to purchase gas. She made it to Oregon in just 3.5 days, which is insane.
Was she doing cocaine on top of this?
That's what I was wondering.
Was that what the $3,000 in cash was for? Sorry.
No, because we find most of it later. But anyway.
Oh, okay.
No, but it's like crazy. I'm like, holy shit. I think that's one of the things I'm going to sidebar for a second. One of the things I've noticed most about getting old is that, like, I get sleepy when I drive now. And I remember being young and being able to just drive for hours, like, in the middle of the night and not even once be like, oh, my God, what if I fall asleep? Now I'm like, oh, my God, it's 2 p.m. I might be a little too sleepy for a long drive.
So I'm pretty sure I have, like, undiagnosed narcolepsy. And when I start, like, feeling this weird feeling, I have to either have somebody else drive or I have to pull over and take a nap because I will just blank out while I'm driving. It's not safe. It doesn't happen as much anymore because I'm more aware of it.
Yeah.
And, like, I can control it. But there's times where, like, I'm in the middle of a trip. I'm like, Jared, we're going to have to pull over and you're going to have to drive because I can't now.
It's just funny to me. Like, I think about being this girl's age and going, oh, my God, I would have totally been like, yeah, we're doing it.
Yeah,
and
now I'm like, I wasn't that person.
Oh, God, like, now I'm like, oh, it's 2 p.m. and I'm a little sleepy.
I guess I was 40 even when I was 20. Mm. Anyway.
So she headed north on I-5, and her trail ends in Brooks, Oregon, at 12:57 a.m. on March 13th, 2000. There's surveillance footage of her at a gas station, and she's alive and well. She's wearing a hat. She comes in. She pays the cashier. Police later observe that she does keep, like, looking outside a couple of times, like she's looking at something, but there's no outdoor cameras, and as far as I'm concerned, that could be whatever. Like, maybe you're a young girl by yourself, and you're, like, in a place getting gas. Like, maybe you're just being extra cautious and looking around. Or who knows? Like you said, maybe, like, some weird dude's out in the parking lot, or a dog walked by, or a cat.
Right? Like, or she saw, like, a nice car that she liked. I don't know.
Could've like, she seems fine. You can see the video. Like, I don't know.
The ghost of Jack Kerouac walks by.
I didn't read a lot into it. But, so, March 18th, okay, is her sister's birthday, and she felt really strongly that she would get a call from her.
Yeah.
Like, that day. She was like, she's gonna call me. Instead, she got a call from the sheriff's office telling her to call the sheriff's office in Bellingham, Washington.
Oh.
And that's when she learned that Leah's Jeep had been discovered in a remote forest. But Leah was not there. So, in that morning, a couple was jogging along what's called Canyon Creek Road. And it's a side route off the Mount Baker Highway. So it's pretty isolated. Like, this is not a road that you, like,
really go down.
Really go on, unless you, A, are a local. Like, these people were jogging on it.
Yeah.
Or, like, you are working for, like a logging company or something. Yeah. So, like, it's, like, the highway, and then this is, like, the side road. So I just say that to say that, like, you know, it was kind of odd that that's where it was. And it's near the Mount Baker Snoqualmie National Forest, which is near the Canada border and about 100 miles from Desolation Peak.
Okay.
So, like, you know, the theory holds that's where she was headed, right?
Yeah.
You know. So they noticed articles of clothing at the side of the road, and then by a slight turn. And that's when they, like, looked down and her Jeep was there. Now, some of the clothing has been was tied to tree branches, which I think is kind of odd.
Uh-huh.
So, obviously, the Jeep's badly damaged. It's down this big embankment.
Do you think maybe she crashed?
Well, from the path the car had taken, the car was going, like, 30 to 40 miles an hour when it went down off the road. The contents of the vehicle were basically tossed as if it had rolled.
Yeah.
Okay. But there was no blood. No sign of, like, injury to an occupant, such as shatter marks on any of the glass or stretching of a seatbelt.
Oh.
So, like, that was really weird.
Yeah.
Like, it was almost like nobody was in the car.
Especially if it rolled.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Like, if it rolled, things would have happened.
Right.
And that's what they said. It would probably occur, like, if a driver or a passenger... You know, it just seemed like nobody was in the vehicle when it crashed. But it also doesn't look like anyone jumped out because there was no blood or anything nearby. Like, there's no sign of physical injury nearby. And they did an assessment of the vehicle, and I don't know exactly how you determine this, but apparently they determined that no one else had traveled in the car with her on the trip. Like, there was no, like, maybe she had stuff everywhere.
Or, like, DNA. Like
yeah, I don't know. And we'll get to more of that later. But the weird thing was, at the bottom, or when they, like, went down and looked at the vehicle, there were blankets and pillows hung inside the windows, like it was used as a shelter after being wrecked. Like, like around the glass and stuff, like somebody tried to wall it up, which is super weird. But, you know, that could have also just been, like, someone drive. Like, it could have been just someone else. It may not be related.
Maybe she knocked it into drive when she meant to go to park and it took off by itself.
Yeah. So, her passport, her checkbook, her driver's license, her clothes, guitar, CDs, other belongings were found scattered around the woods.
Oh.
Cat food and a small cat carrier were found in the vehicle, confirming that the cat was with her. But in a pair of pants, they also found $2,500 in cash and jewelry that was left behind.
Okay.
So, like, robbery was definitely not the motive.
No. Nope.
Like, all this stuff is there. So, her sister and brother fly there to just kind of look at things and give them, their own impression. They go to the crash site and they, you know, they did the flyer, like around town posted.
Yeah.
And, they tried to like go around places that she might have visited, and they found another little box of mementos in her car, and it was stuff from the trip that she was like going to be keeping.
Yeah.
And they found a ticket stub from March 13th for a showing of American Beauty at a theater in Bellingham, Bellis Fair Shopping Mall. So mm-hmm. she went to see the movie American Beauty again. Oh my God. I'm like, what is happening? Like, I loved that movie when I was very young. And it was the beginning of the day. Like the following day, she had drove in from Oregon. So like, it was like the day after she had drove in from Oregon. So basically they just went to, there was a restaurant there. It was the only sit down restaurant. So they went and started asking around, and there were actually, and police were helping too. Like, I don't just mean like the sister and brother are doing this. Like, the police were actually helping. I don't want to, you know, be that person. And two gentlemen remember her talking about Jack Kerouac and her plans. Because, of course, they were probably like, oh, yeah, that girl. Anyway. one of the men claimed, and the other one doesn't confirm this, that she left with a third person whom she heard, they heard her call Barry. They did a police sketch. It's real lame, like all police sketches, in my opinion. And nobody's ever found this Barry or knows any more than that. But, like, they say she left with this guy Barry. So they examined the Jeep. Investigators, the FBI is called in because she crossed state lines. They think that she was the victim of a crime, and their reasoning is really weird. But I'll tell you what I read, and then we can talk about it, I guess.
Okay.
That because of all the money in her pants, like feeling like she put, like, first of all, why are you carrying all your money with you? Second of all, she's like putting on like those, like they feel like she like wasn't there very long.
Yeah.
Which obviously,
yeah.
Like, I don't know what they, like, we know she was in Oregon, like whatever.
Yeah.
So like that proves nothing to me. And then second, they found her mother's engagement ring under a floor mat. And apparently this was something that Leah wore all the time. It was very important to her, and she never took it off unless, like, so, like, someone forced her. And I'm like, maybe it fell off. Like,
yeah.
Anyway, but, I think those are both really weird things to be, like,
but you know. Under the floor mat, though?
Yeah, I know. But, like, the car was tossed.
That's fair.
Like, shit.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
that's fair. I bet shit was everywhere.
Yeah.
So her brother and sister, after 4 days, go back to North Carolina, and there is the theory that she might have been injured in the accident and wandered off. And so police do a search, you know, in the woods, in the area, looking for her. They bring in dogs, helicopters, the whole bit, right? And they just found no trace of her. And I understand that, I mean, you would do the search, like you would. But I also think it's odd that they're also finding that it looks very clearly like nobody was in the vehicle.
Right.
Like,
so still, that's really weird. So it's
really like a weird. Really weird thing. Yeah. But anyway, in 2006, so I'm jumping ahead now a little bit. In 2006, the original detective retired and a new detective came in. And, you know, in most cases like this, they look at it again.
Mm-hmm.
So this time they did a search with the idea with using metal detectors for the rod in her leg.
Oh.
Because, like, you would be able to identify the
serial number.
And, like, if there were remains, you would be able to find it. Or even if their heart, like, remains are pretty scant at this point, you would still be able to figure it out. As I said, she was at the bank, or not the bank, at the gas station alone, but seemed fine. And again, they go back to this idea that maybe this Barry was traveling with her. But again, the other investigators thought that there was nobody else in the car. So, mm-hmm. like, why would they be driving separately? Yeah. I don't know. It's weird.
It is.
And I don't know that Barry has anything to do with this. I think it's just, like, because, like, nobody else could confirm it. Like, the one guy's like, oh, yeah, we both talked to her. And the one guy's like, yeah, she left with Barry. And the other guy's like, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm like, okay,
it's because the guy that's mentioning Barry is really the guy who
I know.
There.
So one, a week after her car was found, they did get a tip. Going backwards again, I don't know. they got a tip that said an anonymous person called and claimed his wife had seen her at a gas station, Leah, acting disoriented. And then they were like asking him more information, and he panicked and hung up, which is super weird.
Yeah.
Super weird. And the gas station in question was a Texaco in Everett, Washington, which is like 30 miles north of Seattle and 60 miles south of where, like, Bellingham, where her Jeep was. So that's really far.
Yeah, yeah.
So, like, the idea that she would have been able to just wander that far is
crazy.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Now, she might have hitchhiked, but, like, to say that she wandered that far,
yeah,
that's pretty...
Without somebody helping her.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, of course, this guy called and hung up, so who knows
yeah.
what he said. According to her sister, in that Larry King episode, she said that the family believed that she could have survived the crash but suffered a head injury and resulted in amnesia or some other, you know, like, mm-hmm. thing. But they did check all, like, because they checked all the nearby hospitals and all of that jazz, you know. But they do think that it's possible that she wandered off and hitchhiked somewhere where she also may have ran into foul play.
Yep.
Like, she may have still, like, yeah. the foul play may not have been the Jeep. The foul play might have happened after.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's hard to say. So her case obviously went cold. And then the police, the sister insisted the police keep the car.
Oh, nice.
Think of it this way. There's no crime scene. There's no, like, defined yep. thing.
Yeah.
The car is the only evidence.
Yep.
It's all they have. So she insisted. And this is super smart.
Good for the sister.
Writing this in my notes for when I go missing. This is super smart because police get rid of evidence all the time. Like, cold case stuff. It happens all the time. Sometimes intentionally. Sometimes just shit happens.
Yeah.
Like, right? Like, things change. Years go on. Like, mm-hmm. anyway. So, like, she's been very insistent. And this really pays off because a new detective was assigned the case. And I believe... nobody looked at the inside, like, nobody lifted the hood to check how, like, the Jeep's mechanics.
Oh.
So they check underneath the hood, and the starter relay cover had been removed, and basically this would enable a person outside the vehicle to push on the relay and accelerate the car without a driver. You just need the key in the ignition. So they could have pressed on it and it, like...
And there's no way she would have known to do that, do you think?
No, not at
right.
all.
Right, okay.
So...
Going back to the guy who said it was
right.
Barry.
So, such... they said, basically, that only someone with pretty advanced mechanical knowledge would
yeah.
know how to do this. So, they went back in to the second man at the restaurant who happened to be a mechanic. So, they got... he was living in Canada, so they finally got him in for fingerprinting and DNA testing, and nothing matched.
Oh.
But it was, like, still, like, that's why you keep the evidence. Also, why would you not have checked to see? You already determined that it looked like nobody was in the vehicle. So
right.
why wouldn't you have tried to figure out how the vehicle got down there?
But not only that, but what DNA evidence?
Well, it was the early 2000s. DNA wasn't quite really a thing. So they
right.
do go back and take all the evidence and retest it for DNA in 2007 because, mm-hmm. like, there was DNA, but it wasn't, like, now.
Yeah, yeah.
It's probably even more now. I don't know if they've tried it, like, any more advancements on it or what. But they did find the presence of male DNA on a piece of her clothing in 2010. Now, they have no match or anything, mm-hmm. and there's nothing that they can really gain from that. But at the same time, that's also pretty, like, random. I mean,
yeah.
it's on a piece of clothing. So who knows? Maybe she, like,
huh.
got it at Goodwill. Maybe she
yeah.
got it from some dude. Like, I don't know. I used to have ex-boyfriend sweatshirts for years.
Right.
Like,
yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Like, I'm not saying. I'm just, you know. Anyway, so basically, the case is still open. They're still looking. And they still have the Jeep. And the quote from the detective was, it's a decades-old time capsule of a soul-searching road trip that ended before it began. Oh, so tragic. But, so anyway, I think that, like, it's clear that the Jeep, I think something happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I think to cover it up, like, her body's somewhere else. And I think to cover it up, somebody pushed that Jeep down that road.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I go back to the idea that she wouldn't have driven on that road,
mm-mm.
Like, that's not the roadmap quest is going to take her on.
Not only that, but it had to be done by a local.
Right. Like, it had to be somebody
who had mechanical knowledge.
Yeah, and I know that that guy didn't match, but, like...
But there were two guys.
I know. So, as of 2022, the last article that I saw, there's nothing new in the case, but it is a really interesting case to me, because I think it's, like... It's real easy to look at it and be like, oh...
Well, and then anonymous man calls and says, look 60 miles this way. So is it that you really saw her, or is it that you're trying to get police to stop looking where they are?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And like I said, they have gone back out and done those searches, which I think is super smart with the metal detectors.
But she's probably on private property.
Yeah, most likely.
Yeah.
But yeah, so, but I think it was funny or interesting to me that it took so long for them to look in the Jeep.
Jesus Christ.
Like, they,
so just to look under the hood.
Because that to me really says clearly this is foul play.
Yes.
Like, this is not she. Nope. Like, the family believed probably for a long time, because it's a lot easier to believe, too, that she just...
Wandered off.
Wandered off, because, like, shit. But...
But she even said, I'm not suicidal, so why would she just fucking wander off like that?
No, I think, So anyway, that's my case, and obviously, not that, like, we have vast listeners, but if anyone knows anything...
Let us know.
Call the police.
All right, I have a title for mine, but it's, It basically just gives away my whole goddamn story, so whatever. Never mind. So we're going to go to Worcestershire, England, which do you think that's where they make Worcestershire shosh?
I think so, yeah.
Amazing. In 1943, it was the middle of World War II, and Britain was enduring nearly nightly air raids and was going through like really rough food rationing. So, because of this, in April of that year, four teenage boys trespassed onto an aristocrat's property by the name of Lord Cobham, and his property was known as the Hagley Estate, and they were hunting for birds and their nests, looking for eggs to put on their tables to feed their family. Like, how sweet, these young boys, just trying to feed their goddamn family during time of war. Like, way to go, kiddos.
Good job.
I know, right? So, their names were Robert Hart, Thomas Willits, Bob Farmer, which I love, and Fred Payne.
Well, Bob Farmer.
Bob Farmer. So, while on the property, the boys found a tree that's called a witch elm. And to see this tree, you're going to have to Google it because it's fucked up. Anyway, it looks more like, it doesn't even look like a tree. It looks more like a bush with no fucking leaves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really weird.
So Bob Farmer climbed the tree in an attempt to find nests hidden in the branches, but found something else instead. And reaching for what he thought was a possible egg, he ended up picking up a skull. Later he states there is a small patch of rotting flesh on the forehead with lank hair attached to it, and the two front teeth were crooked. And due to their illegal trespassing and fear of getting in trouble, he put the skull back in the tree and the boys ran home. They even agreed to a pact of silence in order to keep themselves safe from trouble. However, this agreement of silence did not last long, and one of the boys later that evening spilled everything to his parents, which, good on you. Don't lie to your parents, kids.
Listen.
Just don't.
The body in the tree is going to outweigh your trespassing.
Right? Absolutely.
Yeah.
So the police were called, the boys recanted their story, and then the police went to investigate. So in the hollow of a massive tree trunk is where they find the body. Now, let me say it's a massive tree trunk in like just that it's a big tree, but the space is very narrow. So how you get somebody into this tree, and if you look up the tree, I don't even know how, like, how would you have gotten to the trunk with a body? So anyway, okay, it's all very suspicious. All right, so it's clear that getting this body in there would have taken some effort. As I said, it's a very narrow opening. The police find the skull, but have to cut into the tree trunk in order to examine further, and when they do, they find a full skeleton. Not much is left due to decomposition and probably insects eating away at the body. So the body was taken for forensic examination in Birmingham and was examined by a pathologist named James Webster. And he states that the body was of a woman around the age of 35 who had brown hair. She was 5 foot tall and possibly had given birth at least once. She also had a distinct feature, and that was of her teeth. Her front teeth were very overlapped in a very, very like obvious sort of way. And thinking that this could be a lead, they searched dental records and inquired with dental offices, but came up empty-handed. There we go. But again, this is World War II. It's also decided that...
It's also England.
Yeah, like, I mean, in the middle, like, had she had any dental work, you know, like, I don't think dental offices were really too keen on keeping records at the time because,
well, we're
like,
also talking, I mean, I don't mean to stereotype, but this has been, like, a stereotype about England for a million years.
I mean, yeah, her teeth were bad, but, like, when you see the actual, like, it's...
It's, like, really...
Yeah, okay. Yeah. It's all not right. Just that they're crooked. It's like, it's all almost right. Like one tooth grew halfway in front of the other one, and ooh, they both turned into each other.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So,
yeah, you remember that.
Yeah. It's also decided that she would have been in the tree for around 18 months. But Webster also believed that she was killed near the area of the trees because if not, rigor mortis would have set in and they wouldn't have been able to get her in the tree, and her cause of death was suffocation, and they even found a piece of taffeta in her mouth. There were also objects found around the tree during the investigation. There was a cheap gold wedding band, objects of clothing, which included a blue crepe shoe around the size 5.5, and its mate was on the body inside the tree. But the thing about the shoes is that these would be considered, like, blue crepe was considered a more luxurious type of shoe. And given that she had a cheap gold wedding band, these two things didn't necessarily match. Mm-hmm. But it was found that the shoes were purchased in Dudley in 1940. And then that's kind of like where it ends. So the theory is that maybe these were a gift to her. Mm. And because she didn't have money, she just kept wearing them because they were very worn. So more than likely, she did not buy them for herself. Another object found was an ID near the tree. So the police went to the address on the ID only to find the woman who was on the ID because it belonged to her and she was alive and well. She also had no answers as to why her ID would have been found anywhere near the tree. And then the woman isn't questioned any further and it's left alone.
Of course not.
Right? So Christmas of 1943, the case was kind of, you know, was losing steam.
What about the property?
Again, like, I don't know why. Like, they didn't, I don't think they, Lord whatever, Lord Ham. I don't know that they even talked to him. I know, right? So the case was kind of losing steam and people were kind of losing interest. But that was until graffiti started showing up. The first in Midlands, and the message read, "Who put Lubella down the witch elm?" And then, because there were a few, the others said, "Annabella died in Hagley Wood. Hagley Wood, Lubella was no pross." And then, "Who put Bella in the witch elm?" And then more and more messages would continue to show up around Midlands. And analysis would show that the same person was writing these messages, for a time at least. But who was it? So it was the first time a name had been attributed to the body, so police asked the writer to come forward, and of course no one did. So back through the records, the police went looking for clues, and they did find something. Around the time it suggested that the woman died, there was a call in 1941, and officers responded to a report of hearing a woman's screams near Hagley Wood. At the time, they searched and they didn't find anything. So could this have been the Bella, and could this have been the night that the woman died in the elm? So because this name starts showing up about, you know, attributing, like, everyone starts calling this the woman Bella. Like, mm-hmm. We assume that her name is Bella. So as most mysteries go, there's theories from all corners where public opinion is held. So let's go through some. There's the one where this woman was a supposed Nazi spy who had parachuted and just magically got stuck in the tree. But there was never a parachute debris found. And the hole in the tree was far too small that it's not likely she just magically fell from the sky like some sort of Nazi Mary Poppins. But the thing that pointed
I'm sorry, I'm like, I can't stop envisioning that one.
I know,
one.
Like, it's so just, ridiculous. She would have been impaled first.
It's so ridiculous.
But the thing that pointed to the possibility that she could have been a spy was that no one ever came forward for her saying that they knew her or were related. And that, you know, obviously there were no dental records of her. Another theory was that she was Romani and had committed some crime against her own people. But her clothes didn't match those of the Romani people at the time. But there is evidence that the Romani people did camp in that area around Christmas of 1942. So, I mean, I guess if it was in 1941, anyway. Next is Joseph Jacobs. At one point, the UK spy agency MI5, which, if you remember Mission Impossible,
yes,
released its wartime files, and they mentioned Jacobs. He was an enemy agent, and he parachuted into Cambridgeshire in 1941. He was eventually found walking in a nearby field by farm workers and turned into the police. And in his pocket, they found a photo of a German singer/actress of the time named Clara Borelli. According to Jacobs, Clara was being trained as a spy, and she was supposed to be in England. But this doesn't really match Bella, because Clara was described as being around 6 foot in height, and the body in question was only 5 foot. Also, it supposedly Clara died in Berlin in December of 1942. But around the time of our Bella's death, I just wanted to note, Clara also stopped performing and was not seen again. And a fun fact, Jacobs was the last man to be put to death in the Tower of London in 1941.
Awesome.
I know, crazy, right? So in 1953, another theory was that a Dutch woman named Clarabella Dronkers had been killed by a German spy ring by a British officer and a Dutchman and a music hall artist for, quote-unquote, knowing too much. However, there are no records supporting this theory, but if spies and British officials are involved, why would there be?
Well, and it kind of, it's interesting, that one's interesting too, because the Bella part, mm-hmm. Clara Bella, mm-hmm. and like, that's why no one came forward.
Yeah. Like, well, because like, it's a spy ring.
Yeah, you're not going to be like, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And but somebody had a guilty conscience and was writing the...
Yeah, who killed, yeah, yeah. Then there's the theory of witches and witchcraft, which is my favorite. And enter Margaret Murray, an anthropologist and archaeologist at the University College of London in the year 1945. At the time, she was 82 years old. And her claim to fame was, you know, besides all of her, you know, knowledge, but she was the first woman to publicly unwrap a mummy and was known as the Grand Old Woman of Egyptology. I love that.
What a title.
I know, right? She also studied witchcraft and its history in England, which is what led her to this town. And this is her theory. Around this time, the town was swirling with ghost stories and occult stories of witches practicing their spells in the same woods. And while visiting the town, she heard it all, but there were some things that did catch her attention. Her theory was that a group of followers of ancient pagan religions were still practicing and or had a coven, and they were doing so in secret. She believed what they were doing was rituals to cause supernatural events. Some of these rituals would include sacrificing young women and burying them inside of a tree. The medieval belief that burying a witch in a tree would trap their spirit inside of it. And then there's the name Bella. Her suggestion was that it was short for belladonna, which is a poisonous plant that has been used in various ways, including witchcraft. And then for her, the most significant detail in this case was that of the right hand, which I have not mentioned yet. Bella's right hand had been separated from the body and had been found in a different tree, which is kind of odd. But into this, the evidence for her suggested that whoever did this was trying to make a magical object known as the Hand of Glory. And a Hand of Glory is basically what it sounds like. The left or right hand, whatever hand committed the crime, is cut from the body of a criminal once they have been hung to death. And it was then dried or pickled and was made into a candle. And the reasoning was that the hand held supernatural powers attributed to it.
I can't wait to get my hands on a hand candle.
I know. So, but it's sorry. So if we're going with the witchcraft theory, we know that this, like, our so-called Bella was strangled, possibly hung, because she died from some sort of, yeah, like suffocation. And then they cut off her hand and put it in a different tree as they were burying her in this one. And as far as I know, they never, like, the guy who owned the property, I don't think they ever, I don't know, spoke with him, questioned him. There's, like, I didn't find anything about that. So, but also, you know, rich people love a good, you know, coven devil worship.
Yeah.
I mean, the Hellfire Club, you know.
The interesting thing about this, too, I mean, like, I can see why there's so many theories.
Yeah.
But I'm also like, dude, this is World War II.
Yeah.
Like, people are getting displaced and dying all, yeah, over the place. Maybe her family's just dead.
Yeah.
You know? That's true. And like, maybe she was alone in the world and trying to figure shit out. And maybe it's like, I don't know, like a Kennedy thing, and she,
yeah,
like,
yeah,
you know, had a ill-fated affair with a son of a lord and,
right,
I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, it could eat, it could, like, the witchcraft theory is really, like,
it's fun.
It's interesting.
It's fun. But it's, like, I don't think it's,
in, yeah, this time period, the
I think there are more significant things happening than people just being like, yeah, we're going to do some pagan shit.
Yeah, like, it's just interesting. Yeah. But yeah, like, if this happened not during World War II. Like,
right. So thankfully, before any sort of witch hysteria could ignite, on May 8, 1945, Germany surrendered, and the war that had been raging in Europe for 6 years finally ended. One of the troops who came home was named Warwick, and upon learning about the mysterious murder, he had a story to tell. Several years prior, while working at his parents' pub, he was approached by a woman named Bella who wanted a job singing and playing piano for tips, which she did. At some point, he says that his mother gave Bella a pair of blue crepe shoes, just like the one found on the body. He also says that one day Bella came into the pub, clearly beaten up, and when he asked what happened, she stated that her landlord had attacked her, and after that night, he didn't see her again. He tried to find her on orders from his mother, but he couldn't. The police didn't really take this report seriously under the basis that all of the details of the case at this point were publicly known and he could have made it all up for attention. So they don't do anything with the story and it goes nowhere.
That's way more intriguing. Seriously.
So in 1953, journalist Wilfred Byford Jones wants to write a column for his newspaper about the Hagley Wood mystery. So he visits the town. He tracks down the four boys, but at this point in time, they didn't want to talk about it anymore. And then he runs an ad instead, promising £100 for anyone with information who was also willing to talk. And clearly, this loosened more than a few tongues, and letters came pouring in. But there was one letter that stood out above the rest, and this is what it said. Finish your articles regarding the Witch Elm crime by all means. They are interesting to the reader, but you'll never solve the mystery. One person who could give you the answers is now beyond the jurisdiction of earthly courts. The only clues that I can give you are that the person responsible for the crime died. Insane in 1942, and the victim was Dutch and alive. Illegally in England around 1941. I have no wish to recall any more. The letter was signed by someone named Anna, and there was no last name and no return address. The only clue was that it had been postmarked from a village 10 miles north of Hagley. So Wilfred posts another article begging the Anna to come forward and speak in person. And eventually she did. But her name wasn't actually Anna. It was Una Mossop, and she told her story. And according to her, her story was about her husband Jack, who was a worker for the Royal Air Force and had worked at the munitions factory in Birmingham. But the job was shit and it didn't pay very well. And because of that, she became suspicious when Jack started coming home wearing a lot of really expensive clothing, including a Royal Air Force officer's uniform. He started coming home later and later. He had more nights with friends at the pub, including a Dutchman known as Von Rolt. She concluded that Von Rolt was a Nazi spy and that her husband was trading military secrets to him. Because of the Birmingham, to note, was the base of the English military production and at the time was being heavily bombed and littered with spies because of the military production. So according to Una, late one night in 1941, her husband returned home drunk, late, and slurring something about a murder but wouldn't go into detail. And in the typical wife badgering-like style, he finally relented and told her the story. Jack and Von Rolt had been out that evening drinking with the Rolt's girlfriend, which is assumed she was also a spy. The three went for a drive. The couple had some sort of an argument, but were speaking a language that Jack didn't understand, and Von Rolt attacked his girlfriend, knocking her either unconscious or possibly killing her. It's not really clear what happened. So Jack stopped the car and then helped him carry his girlfriend into the woods and helped shove her into the tree. Eventually, the body is found, and Una starts to believe her husband's story and that he had been telling the truth all along. After that, his mental health slowly starts to decline. He claims that he's haunted by visions of the woman, of this woman, who was always leering at him through the hollow of the tree that they left her in. And then in 1942, he checks himself into a mental institution and dies a few months later. Now, to back this story up, there was a police report in 1941 that had been overlooked at the time, but now they found it. In the report, an officer finds a car pulled over to the roadside. He approaches and he finds a man and a woman. In the seat is a Royal Air Force officer jacket, And he thought, honestly, that he was just interrupting something, and he quickly lets them go. This could also correlate with the police reports of a woman in the woods screaming. And the one thing I want to note is that the police officer saw only two people in the car, not three. So where did Van Rolt go?
Right.
The story doesn't answer the questions to the graffiti across the town that kept going well after the case went cold.
Well, the guy went crazy. Maybe he was, like...
doing it?
Yeah.
Yeah. But they think that the continued messages were just works of copycats. And Una doesn't mention the girl's name being Bella, nor does she state she had been writing the messages, so who knew what, you know? Like, yeah. Who knows what? And as you can guess, this case goes cold. And at this point, anyone who would have known anything at this point, they are dead, sadly. But there's one last thing about this case that'll make you scratch your head and say, huh. So, the body. As I mentioned, her body was sent to Dr. Webster in Birmingham University. He retired in 1955, and his successor, Dr. Griffiths, the remains were passed on to him. The actual body from the elm is now missing. Although the possibility of DNA studies to be done now could help shine some sort of a light on the case, it's currently impossible. Birmingham counselor Peter Douglas Osborne confirmed with the West Midland Police states, searches have been conducted by the police museum volunteers, and they have confirmed that we hold no exhibits and can find no documentation that may relate to this case at either of the West Midlands police museums. Additionally, searches were carried out by our Force Records team, who have confirmed that there is no relevant documentation held with the major investigation team or in external storage. So to add to the already piled up mystery of this case, more is missing aside from the biggie, which is her body. So more things that are missing are the original police notes, witness statements, and all the crime scene photos have now all disappeared. And I just want to note that the person in charge, it was somebody named Stella Remington, and was working as an archivist around the same time that all of this disappeared. Stella would also go on to become a director of MI5. Mm-hmm. So whatever happened to the person whom we now refer to as Bella, it must have been a crazy enough story that there are no trails have been left behind.
That is really crazy.
Isn't that nuts?
Yeah.
Like, nothing. Nothing at all.
Which leads me, like, makes me go back to the spy thing.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Which is why, like,
because at first, I really... the story of the bartender, like, that one to me rings really true.
Oh, yeah.
Because, like you said, like, she couldn't probably afford those shoes, but, her, like, the woman gave them to her. Like,
yeah.
It all kind of fits.
Yeah.
But then, with all the stuff going, like, nobody would do that for...
And then, like, why? Who's Von Rolt? How do we know that her husband wasn't Von Rolt?
Right.
And, like, that was maybe his, like, spy name. That was the name that he was using. And maybe he met this other woman, and they were working together, and he killed, and then what if he ended up killing her? Like, maybe that was part of his orders, you know? Like, just because the police officer only saw two people, not one. So,
yeah.
Either way, we're
super interesting, though.
Most people who would know anything about this are dead.
Yeah.
And unless MI5 releases any information that they have on it, which I don't think that they will, it's just one of those cases that will forever be unsolved.
Yeah.
Which is sad.
It is. It's an interesting case, though. I love, like, I don't love dead people in trees. Yeah, yeah. I love the idea that, like, I think the most intriguing part is somebody did this graffiti, right?
Yeah.
And then, like, it gave it its own, like, crazy life. Because, honestly,
yeah,
without that, it probably would have even...
Nobody would have cared.
It would have gone away because, like, it would, like I said, I keep saying it. It was World War II. There's a lot of other things happening.
Right. People had other issues.
Other concerns.
They didn't care. You know, it was interesting, but we didn't care.
Yeah. Like, okay, another person's dead. There's,
big,
like,
deal.
Everyone's dying.
Right. We're getting bombed on a fucking nightly basis because there were night raids happening, like, really often, and... Yeah. So anyway, that's our stories. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, friends.
And maybe we'll see you next week. I don't actually know what's happening.
I don't know what's going on. Oh, yeah, anymore. I'm good next week. But we'll have to see.
Yeah. All right. Your moms love you.
Bye.
Bye.